This is day three of this June 2015 7-day session. We'll return to our text we've been using, the book Zen Letters, the teachings of 11th century Chinese Zen master Yuan Wu, translated by J.C. Cleary and Thomas Cleary. Here's the start of a new letter that he wrote, to whom we don't know. Could have been a monk, a layperson, a householder, a woman, a man. He starts by quoting Joshu, Zhao Zhou. Zhao Zhou said, "During my 30 years in the South, the only times I mixed mundane concerns into my mental activity were during the morning and noon meals." Kind of staggers the imagination that in 30 years, the only time he mixed mundane concerns into his mental activity were during morning and noon meals. It's not quite clear what he meant by this. As always, it rests somewhat on the translation, the translator's choice of words, mundane concerns. It's hard to imagine he could have meant that the only time he ever had a thought were during morning and noon meals. And then Yuan Wu comments, "From this we should realize that in carrying out this matter, the ancient worthies did not take it as a casual thing. On the contrary, they took it seriously and treated it with respect. That's how they persevered in their practice and attained insight. That's how they reached thoroughgoing clarity and never fell into empty vanity in action or speech." Empty vanity in action or speech. You would also expect that they would have avoided falling into empty vanity in thoughts as well. Most people, I think it's fair to say, most people are pretty much constantly thinking about themselves. If not directly, the I or the my, then it's something self-referential, something related to oneself. There was a high government official and devout Zen practitioner in the time of Rinzai, Linchi, who said, "Why are people so unhappy? Because 99% of what they think about is themselves, and there is none." This phrase, I think, is worth commenting on, that the ancient worthies did not take this practice as a casual thing. They took it seriously and treated it with respect. What drove them to take it so seriously and have it practice it so assiduously? It could be just the pure desperation of needing to know their nature, needing to know the nature of reality. It would almost have to be that as one motivation that would cause them to treat it so desperately. And related to that is their awareness of the impermanence of things, awareness of their mortality, the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. I think it's hard for us who live in a time when life expectancy is so much longer than in Tang Dynasty China. It's hard for us to know, to imagine what life would have been like then, with undoubtedly with death so ubiquitous, family members, immediate family members, extended family members, members of the town, of the immediate community, and the visibility of the elderly, the sick and the injured. Relatively speaking, we don't see these, what in Buddhism were called the three sights, sickness, old age, and death. We're very much protected from them. Of course, unless they strike right close to home. So they were constantly being reminded of the fragility of life. This is probably the single most powerful fuel for treating this practice seriously and taking it seriously and treating it with respect. Treating it with respect, you respect it as the way out of this suffering. The way out. Relief from suffering. Blind suffering that as human beings we seem alone to have because of our sense of self, our strong compulsion to make all these things self-referential. Pain, we know, is a condition of life of any creature. All beings suffer pain, but this human secondary or additional pain that is often called suffering, this would seem to be unique to us. That is, in making the pain about oneself. Once read a book about daily life in the Tang era. It was very sobering how immediate this most kind of grinding pain was of all kinds people were exposed to. We don't need, really, we don't need to place ourselves in environments of great suffering if we can wake up to our own suffering. Because it's there. It's not the same as these other kinds of extreme kinds of suffering, but it doesn't have to be for us to be reminded of this first of the Four Noble Truths. We see it in our zazen. That's where we put on our high-powered lens and look into the mind, and we see the many little but persistent ways in which we incur unnecessary suffering through our attachment to the notion of a self. And it's in the end, it's about one's affinity with the Dharma. If one has a strong enough affinity, then ongoing practice will prompt us to want to go on and to resolve these matters of suffering. And then if it's not that strong, then at some point we'll glance off this kind of inner suffering that we have and go elsewhere, do something else. But there's so much that we can mine of the ways in which we cause ourselves unnecessary suffering. The cause of our sorrow is ego delusion. We come to see how clear the cause is. He continues, in the present time, those who want to draw near to reality must boldly mobilize their energies and transform what is within them. You must not cling to wrong knowledge and wrong views. Oh, wrong knowledge and wrong views. Any of these big conceptual attachments that we have, notions about the way things are, that is, as we frame reality, the way we've come to see people and things, ideas about the way people should be, the way that the delusions about who we are, which are often just that, delusions, mistaken ideas that we have formed through painful childhood experiences, ideas of good and bad, success and failure, right and wrong, better and worse. These are deep stains in the mind that we become awfully familiar with in doing zazen. These are the real thoughts that cause problems, not the little distracting things that go in and out of the mind, but these deeply ingrained ideas about things and people and ourselves. Ideas about enlightenment and delusion. The idea that I'm not enlightened, so therefore I have to go out there and find it somewhere. Ideas about one's deficits, one's insufficiencies, which are always delusions. So he says he must not cling to wrong knowledge and wrong views. Okay, we have them. We all have them. Certainly when we begin practice. But let's not cling to them, at least. Let's not nurse them. That's what we have to do to unravel these things that have built up over the years. Just don't cling to them. You must not mix poison into your food. Well, that's really what he's talking about. All of these things is mixing poison into our spiritual sustenance, what could be our spiritual sustenance if we could move through our lives without these delusions. You must be uniformly pure and true and clean and wondrously illuminated to step directly into the scene of the fundamental ground. The scenery of the fundamental ground, and reach the peaceful and secure stage of great liberation. To be clear, we don't have to be uniformly pure and true and clean and wondrously illuminated to have a first experience of awakening. But he's referring, no doubt, to great, he says, great liberation. And he continues, then you stand aloof and alone so that wind cannot blow in and water cannot wet you. The true essence becomes manifest, and in your daily activities you have a measure of power. As you hear sounds and see forms, you don't give rise to grasping or rejecting. With every move, you have a road to get out on. Well, to have a road to get out on with every move is the space that can open up in the mind between circumstances and our reaction to them, between people, what they say and do, and our reaction to them. That's the road out, is that space where we are free to choose how to respond. And we're not just acting out of blind passions, anger, or many other troublesome emotions. You don't give rise to grasping or rejecting. There's a lot about that in the chant we do, affirming faith in mind. This is fundamental to Buddhist teaching, is that as human beings we could say that our primary problem, besides expressing it as ego delusion, the primary problem is dividing our lives into our liking what we like and what we don't like, what we want to grasp for and what we want to reject. It's another thing that comes through long practice, is seeing how what a knee-jerk reflex we have to do this all the time. Mostly, we don't notice it, but through ongoing practice we come to see how much our lives are wrapped around us trying to get what we want and try to avoid what we don't want. Which is natural enough. It's natural, but so is unnecessary suffering. In the statement, talking about great liberation, when he says, then you stand aloof and alone. Alone. This has nothing to do with loneliness. It has nothing to do with separation. On the contrary, this alone is all one. This is the radical sovereignty of a self that has swallowed up anything that one could construe as other than self. It's just this one mind. Here's another letter where he begins by quoting Zhao Zhou. I don't like to hear the word Buddha. And then Yuan Wu says, tell me, why was he like this? Was it because Buddha means omniscient person that he didn't want to hear the word? Clearly this was not the reason. Since it wasn't this, then why didn't he want to hear the word? If you are a clear-eyed person, then you'll grasp it as soon as you hear of this. Let me ask you, what does it really mean? Try to divulge what you think about this so I can see. this was this kind of warning was just everywhere in early Zen, the Tang Dynasty and the Sung Dynasty. The masters were always saying, don't imagine that Buddha is something outside yourself. Hakuin himself, at the end of the Hakuin chant, this very body, the body of Buddha. So there was a way in which people in the early centuries of Buddhism would make a thing about Buddha. And that's the last thing we ever want to do, is make a thing about anything. It's especially, it so easily becomes something apart from us, and that's the basic delusion, to think that Buddha is somewhere other than our own nature. I think the modern version of that, the contemporary version, is the word enlightenment. Every time we use the word enlightenment, we risk understanding it as something out there. There is a place for speaking of enlightenment, at least if you're a teacher. I think it's vital that we never deny or ignore the possibility of this experience. But it's risky, because it so easily becomes a goal. So I would say the contemporary version is, I don't like to hear the word enlightenment. It's actually painful a little bit to use the word, once you've seen that it is, there's no one who is out without this enlightened nature. He continues in this letter, when Luzu saw a monk coming, he would face the wall. Was this helping people or not? Where is the proper proportion? If you want to act in accord with him, what approach should you take? So he's presenting these rhetorical questions. This is a famous master who, whenever he saw a monk coming, he would turn and face the wall. And Yuan Wu is asking here, was this helping people or not? Where is the proper proportion? This is a question that a teacher faces day in and day out. To what extent do you you teach in the traditional sense of the word, the conventional sense of the word, and to what extent do you leave it for the student to come to her or his understanding? How much do you spell it out? Depends on the student. Luzu went all the way to one extreme, just left it all to the student, not a word of teaching. There are Zen temples I've heard of where during Sesshin there are no talks of any kind, no teishos, no talks in the Zendo, no doksan, no stick, no chanting, just sitting. There might be someone every once in a while who could really run with that, but I think it's too much for most people. Not just too much, it's not textured enough as a way of presenting, practicing the Dharma. That's why it's so rare. It's almost unheard of. Throughout the history of Zen, there have always been talks, and devotional practices, chanting, ceremonies. All of these things together create a fullness of experience. And then here's another famous story. He said every time Baizhang was one of the earliest of the Tang Dynasty masters and great illustrious master. Every time Baizhang went to the hall, when he had finished expounding the Dharma and the assembly was disappearing, he would call to them again. When they turned around, he would say, "What is it?" This question or its other variation, what is this, what is it, what is this, became the primary breakthrough koan in Korean Zen. What is it? Next letter. Da Wei, the patch-robed one, with his fearless and sharp nature, traveled all over the country visiting the expert craftsmen of the Zen school. Da Wei is credited as having revived the school of Linqi, the whole koan system, and then it fell into decline again after him and then was revived once more by Hakuin. The former prime minister and Zen master Zhang Wujin came to know of him and respected him deeply as a vessel of the teaching. Since Da Wei had an extraordinary spirit, he was not content to follow small understanding. He was not content to follow small understanding. It says so much about the character, the aspiration of Da Wei. As it did, as Hakuin was the same. According to the records, he had one enlightenment experience after another, and yet persevered, always going deeper, continuing to strive to understand more completely, more fully. There's a great saying, I don't know who said this, I'm sure it was from China. The non-enlightened must strive as if mourning their parents. The enlightened too must strive as if mourning their parents. Since Da Wei had an extraordinary spirit, he was not content to follow small understanding. After demonstrating his sincerity, he became one of my associates. We reached accord at a single word, and he shed the halter that had hitherto bridled him. Though he had still not reached total comprehension, he was a robust and lively fellow whom nobody could suppress or rein in. When we trace back where this came from, after all, it was due to Master Wu Jin inspiring him. It must have been Da Wei's teacher. Subsequently, Da Wei braved the freezing cold and came for a while to visit me at Shanping. When he came to announce his departure, he asked for some words of teaching, which I accordingly gave him. This is what I told him. Those who wear the patched robe of a Zen monk should be completely serious about taking death and birth as their business. You should work to melt away the obstructions caused by conditioned knowledge and views and interpretive understanding. and penetrate through to a realization of the great causal condition communicated and bequeathed by the Buddhas and ancestral teachers. Don't covet name and fame. Step back and turn to reality until your practical understanding and virtue are fully actualized. Serious about taking death and birth as their business. We have it on the Han, the wooden block that is suspended outside the Zendo in Rochester. Great is the matter of birth and death. Life slips quickly by. Time waits for no one. Wake up, wake up. Don't waste a moment. And this isn't just in Zen that we hear this exhortation to work while we have the time, while we have the rare opportunity of having encountered the Dharma, a practice that can help us see through birth and death. Milarepa, the great Tibetan yogi, spoke as if addressing householders even today. Affairs and business will drag on forever, so lay them down and practice now the Dharma. If you think tomorrow is the time to practice, suddenly you find that life has slipped away. Who can tell when death will come? And yet it's a rare person who can take this to heart, really to heart, and lay down affairs and business to practice the Dharma, even while remaining a householder. I'm not talking about becoming a monk. Maybe Milarepa is. But even aside from that, short of that, finding a way to carve out the time every day to do some sitting. This is the minimum one should be sure to do if one wants to get very far in Zen. Over the years, I've come to understand from what people have said and what they've implied that really an astonishing number of people don't sit regularly. What do they think they can get out of Zen? In order to benefit from Zen, you've got to do it. You've got to do the practice and not just now and then. It's got to become part of the fabric of your life. Find a way. Otherwise, don't expect much from it. It's not going to do much for you if you don't do it. Zen Master Dogen said, "Time doesn't pass in vain. People pass their time in vain." Again, Yuan Wu's words to the great Da Wei, "You should be completely serious about taking death and birth as your business. You should work to melt away the obstructions caused by conditioned knowledge." Well, that's Zazen. We don't have to think about melting anything away. We just have to do daily Zazen, and there will be the melting away of these obstructions, these endless blind passions. He says, step back and turn to reality. Okay. Step back and turn to reality. We get a chance to do this moment by moment. Every time we notice that the mind has wandered into thoughts, we can return it to the koan if we're working on a koan, the breath if we're working on the breath. or in our daily lives, just return it to this, just this. Right here, this very presence. That's the only reality we can possibly know. All the thoughts, the thoughts of the past, thoughts of the future, fantasies, this is all just dust in the mind. It's not reality, really. And this is, he continues in his talking to Dawei. When there is real attainment, the more you try to hide it, the more it cannot be concealed. All the sages and the devas and nagas will try to push a person of real attainment forward, especially after years of cultivation and refinement. In other words, we're really not alone in this work. We have the support of forces that we can't even know. This is the wind at our back in practice. If we meet it halfway, make a decent effort at this, and we will be buoyed, we will be borne along by these bodhisattvas and buddhas, if you will. Wait until you are like a bell sounding when struck, or a valley returning an echo. Wait until you are like pure gold coming forth from a forge where it has been smelted and refined 10,000 times, so that it will not change in 10,000 generations, so that it is 10,000 years in a single moment. He continues, when the grip of transcendence is in your hand, when the grasses bend down as the wind blows, then won't you be expansive and generous with resources to spare? Remember, what is important in practice is perseverance and consistency. These come to us from 1,000 years ago, and they're no less true today. Perseverance and consistency. How do we do that? There has to be the need. Roshi Kapo used to say, well, everyone needs Zazen. Everyone needs this practice, but not everyone has a felt need for it. We have to feel the need for it. And that is something that really and ultimately comes down to, again, our affinity with this practice. We can't contrive to have a need for it. Yuan Wu seems to be very fond of this phrase, when the grasses bend down as the wind blows. We have these two aspects. We have the aspect of this one mind, and the aspect of the many, the undifferentiated and the differentiated. Could say the in the ocean, the surface waves of the ocean and the depths, the silent depths of the ocean. It starts, this practice for full maturity practice, it starts with realizing the depths, realizing this one wind before which all the many things will bow down. It's one wind of no thingness before which all things will bend. Next letter. By even speaking a phrase to you, I have already doused you with dirty water. It would be even worse for me to put a twinkle in my eye and raise my eyebrow to you, or rap on the meditation seat, or hold up a whisk, or demand, "What is this?" As for shouting and hitting, it's obvious that this is just a pile of bones on level ground. Here we see the radical nature of great Zen teachers, where he says all of this, all of these devices are somehow extra, when in truth we all know the way. In our deepest recesses, we know this. You see this lament by Zen teachers in the old texts so often, lamenting, bringing forth words that can just complicate things, potentially, and yet they know that they can also, they have this other side where they can reveal things and point to this moon of the mind, can inspire people, but always at the risk of people getting tangled up in words and phrases. And also these other things, a twinkle of my eye, raising my eyebrow, rapping on the meditation seat, and so forth. All of these signs, these signals, these teachings can be misunderstood by students. Gute holding up a finger. This is the third case in the Mumonkan collection of koans. His attendant, young attendant, would start imitating him. This was his kind of teaching, Gute's kind of teaching, where he would just hold up one finger, and then his attendant started imitating him. And one day, as the legend goes, the master cut off the boy's finger, and at that the boy came to enlightenment. Why would he do that? Why? What would be wrong with the boy imitating Gute, holding up that finger? Or if it had imitated him by raising his eyebrow or hitting the mat with a stick? If it's imitation, it's not true. It's something else. That's what Yuan Wu is warning us about. There are also the type who don't know good from bad and ask questions about Buddha and Dharma and Zen and the Tao. They ask to be helped. They beg to be received. They seek knowledge and sayings and theories relating to the Buddhist teaching and to transcending the world and to accommodating the world. This is washing dirt in mud and washing mud in dirt. When will they ever manage to clear it away? He's, of course, talking about people who, in these various ways, still imagine that the truth, so-called, the Dharma, is out there somewhere, rather than within oneself, one's own mind. Some people hear this kind of talk and jump to conclusions, claiming, "I understand. Fundamentally, there is nothing to Buddhism. It's there in everybody. As I spend my days eating food and wearing clothes, has there ever been anything lacking?" Then they settle down in the realm of unconcerned ordinariness, far from realizing that nothing like this has ever been part of the real practice of Buddhism. He's talking here, of course, about people who become attached to these ideas. They haven't experienced it. They haven't confirmed the truth of these things. But they use these ideas as a way to just sort of wash their hands of it and become complacent. This is what the Japanese call Buji Zen, falling into this trap of thinking, okay, we've always been enlightened, we've always been full Buddhas from the very beginning, well, each one of us is the manifestation of the Dharma. All of our actions are the functioning of our true nature. Yes, a teacher would say that. But until you've experienced that, confirmed it through awakening, you have no business saying that. It's not out of your own experience. And much less using that as excuses for just packing it in and not doing the work. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.